It takes time and money to fully do risk assessments on some of your supply chain partners. And the speed of business is not always the speed of security.
All that and more on Security Intelligence. Hello and welcome to Security Intelligence, IBM's weekly cybersecurity podcast, where our expert panelists turn the biggest industry news stories into practical takeaways you can use. I'm your host, Matt Kaczynski, recording live from the Blizzard of 26 and wishing a happy IBM X-Force Threat Intelligence Index Day to all who celebrate. Joining me on this festive day, Claire Nunez, Creative Director, X-Force Cyber Range, and two brand new faces to the panel, Chris Caridi, Cyber Threat Analyst, X-Force Strategic Threat Analysis, and Joe Satrich, CTM Chief Architect. And here's what we're talking about today, folks. Can you steal the soul of an AI agent? The flaws in AI infrastructure that make cyber attacks all too easy, and a more human approach to threat intelligence. But first, as I indicated up top, we have to kick it off with the 2026 IBM X-Force Threat Intelligence Index. Hot off the presses today, the Threat Intelligence Index, or TII, pulls data from X-Force incident response and pen testing engagements, as well as the dark web and other sources, to compile a comprehensive report on the cyber threat landscape over the last year. Some of the biggest trends in this year's report, quote, a surge in broad-based exploitations of exposed systems, weaknesses in software supply chains, and growing systemic dependencies across cloud and application ecosystems. Now, there's a lot in here, and Chris, I know you were one of the authors on this report, so I just want to start with you. Tell us, what are the big things on your mind? What's standing out for you this year in the TII?
Yeah, so I guess the first thing that stands out to me is the increase in the exploitation of public-facing applications, a 44% increase, actually, which is rather significant. Additionally, over half of those vulnerabilities did not require authentication to exploit, which is a rather big deal for us.
Yeah, and I was wondering if you had any thoughts about why we're seeing this massive exploitation increase. You know, I know that for the last few years, credential theft was one of the top ones. You know, identity-based attacks was like a top attack vector. And this year, we saw these exploitation of public-facing applications surge by 44%. Any thoughts on what's driving the shift in tactics, Chris?
Yeah, I think it reflects a rise in the supply chain attacks targeting the development ecosystems and trust and infrastructure, right? So there's a lot more implementations going around, right, where we have multiple systems kind of talking to each other. And with that, we're getting, you know, a first-hand look at some of those exploits that are being utilized and exploited by attackers.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It reminds me of something that Jeff Krum has said many times on the show, which is that you can have two very secure components, but that gap where they talk to each other can become a vulnerability, right? And so, as you mentioned, these increasingly sophisticated supply chains, these increasingly complex supply chains open up a lot of possible activity or real estate for attackers to hone in on. Joe, I want to ask you if you have any thoughts here about the report in general. Anything stick out to you as you were taking a look at it? Anything really kind of igniting your fire right now?
Yeah, well, a couple of things. We see the uptick in, you know, public-facing applications, and they should have been secured, but everyone's jumping those protocols and where are we going? And things that should be part of our day-to-day, like multi-factor authentication, and are we securing the code? Are we doing the right thing? Following the right steps? And those things that are being missed, it shouldn't be missed. It shouldn't be an uptick, but it is.
And I'm glad you bring that up, because this is something that comes up in the report, and it's something that comes up again a lot on the show, which is that, like, security 101, basic hygiene, is still a huge weakness for a lot of us, right? Like you mentioned, Joe and Chris, actually, I think it was Chris who said, well, it was something like 50% of the exploitations were unauthenticated, right? Like you didn't have to authenticate to use them. What was the number on that, Chris? Could you remind me?
Yeah, it was 56%.
56%, so even higher than 50%, right? Joe, I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on why, after all this time, you know, security 101 is still so tough, why it's still such a big spot of vulnerabilities. Any takes there?
Well, and this is what I'm thinking on this. And nowadays, it's easier to put public-facing applications in. It's easier for users just to go ahead and create things and have not been involved with the development of applications in the past and all the steps that you have to take and how to secure them, make sure that the code is closed and valid and so on and so forth. And it's since it's easier for people to do it, they just go ahead and do it without any thought on the consequences that that may have, right? And maybe they're not even part of the security personnel or the DevOps or development or anything. They just now have the ease of doing it.
Claire, I want to bring you in now. You know, you taking a look at this report, what stuck out for you? What were the things that really caught your attention this year?
Yeah, so I love TII season, but I'm often disappointed because our stats, you know, organizations are not changing things enough. Like, we're still seeing manufacturing be the top industry again, which is not a surprise at all. It's very lucrative to attack manufacturing organizations. But the stat that really caught my eye was the 4 times increase of the major supply chain breaches. We tackle that a lot in the cyber range, and organizations still, you know, aren't always doing their due diligence with their supply chain partners. So I think that was a very interesting stat, and I will definitely be using it for some clients.
Yeah, and you know, Chris already kind of touched a little bit on the supply chain and why there's so many people targeting it. But you had mentioned there you feel like maybe there's some due diligence that's missing. And I wonder if you could say a little bit more about that angle of things. What do you think might be going on there?
Yeah, I mean, I guess clients, it takes time and money to fully do risk assessments on some of your supply chain partners. It takes, you know, you can't onboard a partner as quickly. And the speed of business is not always the speed of security. So it's interesting. Organizations aren't always fully, you know, keeping up to date, checking and patching things as needed. So it's just something that people don't always put all the effort in that they should.
Yeah, the speed of business is not the speed of security. I really like that because we talk about this tension a lot on the show, right? And about how security in the business, there's a need to align these things, but they don't always align perfectly, right? And so it takes a little bit of manual effort there to make those things line up. And before we start talking about maybe how we can line them up, there's still a couple other things I want to dig into with the report. And the first is credential theft, right? As I mentioned, in years past, this was a top attack vector. This year, it fell into second place, but it's still pretty significant. It was the initial attack vector in 32% of incidents. Chris, I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about why credential theft is so popular. It's still second place. Why do hackers like targeting credentials?
Yeah, sure. It's a good question. So, I mean, the answer is actually pretty simple. You know, I guess the best way to explain is that it's low cost and it's incredibly effective for attackers. And you know, it's low effort for them if they have valid credentials, right? They don't have to invest time and resources into finding exploits or doing, you know, lengthy reconnaissance. They can just, you know, basically log in, right? Instead of hacking. That's kind of what we referred to in the report. So it allows them to speed up their process. And you know, it's a win-win for them because it's when you use legitimate credentials to you know, conduct operations, you make you're more difficult to detect because you're kind of masquerading as a legitimate user. So you know, it has a lot of pluses from an attacker perspective.
It makes a lot of sense, right? I mean, first of all, we know that passwords are notoriously a weak kind of credential. People will reuse them a lot. They'll keep very basic ones. And like you said, it lets you not only walk through that front door easier because you're logging in like a normal person, or rather an authorized user, but once you're in, you still look like an authorized user, right? And so you can fly under that radar. Another change we saw this year was the prevalence of targeting AI credentials, right? I know that the report mentioned finding over 300,000 ChatGPT credentials exposed on the dark web, which that's a lot of ChatGPT credentials. Joe, any thoughts on why AI chatbot credentials are such a hot target for attackers right now?
Well, yeah, I mean, imagine right now AI and all the capabilities it can do. I think people and organizations are just giving it permission to AI to do vast majority of things. They have multiple access to a lot of, you know, domain servers, databases, so on and so forth, to allow it to do whatever is it the task for, you know, productivity's sake, that you want to use, you give it permission. So if I'm able to get a hold of those credentials, get, you know, kind of steal the AI soul a little bit, I'm not only getting access to AI, I'm getting access to a lot of things. And from there, I can pretty much steal a lot of data, you know, ransomware would be easier to perform and all of that. So it's not only a hot topic, it's also a desired one.
Yeah, and that's foreshadowing one of the stories we're going to talk about today, right? This idea of when you steal, when you get into an AI agent, or not just an AI agent, but AI chatbot, any of these tools, you can get into its capabilities as well, right? It's not just like your average data breach where you get some data, which is nice and lucrative, but these things have permissions and privileges that you can leverage. And that's a whole new attack surface, right? I mean, the past few weeks, we've talked a lot about OpenClaw, and it's going to come up later again. But these AI agents become such valuable targets for attackers because they just open up possibilities that weren't there before. Another interesting aspect of the report was that X-Force Red, the OFSEC portion of X-Force, organized the results of penetration testing engagements according to the MITRE Corporation's Common Attack Pattern Enumeration and Classification, or CAPEC, framework. And the most common attack patterns they saw in their activities included exploiting incorrectly configured access control security levels, scanning for vulnerable software, and password brute forcing. Again, we're looking at a lot of that security 101 stuff, basically, right? Claire, you know, you work in the cyber range. You do a lot of training with organizations. How do these common attack patterns stack up against what you tend to see or what you feel like organizations tend to struggle with?
Usually in the actual range engagement itself, we're kind of exploring broader business issues, but the initial attack vector for a lot of our scenarios, we do often bring it back to a very simple human element. Someone clicking a phishing link, someone's credentials being insecure, weak. We do it because that's what we see in the wild. Humans are still the weakest link. You can have a lot of technical issues, but you also just need one person to click something and they just happen to be an admin. So we bring that in a lot, and it often is something very simple because a lot of our organizations come in and they say, yeah, we did a phishing test and our numbers are pretty bad still. So it's something that organizations struggle with, but you know, they're trying to mitigate the later business issues that stem from that.
Absolutely. And speaking of mitigation, you know, look, we've been harping a lot so far on some of the unsettling and upsetting findings, some of the things that don't sound so good. But how about some of these positive takeaways, right? And so to close out this segment, I want to go do a little roundtable here. What do you think are the important kind of key takeaways for organizations and defenders here that they can use to maybe strengthen things, mitigate some of this, help security and the business move at a similar pace? Chris, I'll start with you. What do you think are like some of the main proactive takeaways here?
One of my first recommendations would be to make sure you have a grasp of what your actual footprint is, especially your external footprint, knowing what assets you have that are exposed publicly, including things like domains and anything that might be located on the dark web, the deep web. Understanding kind of your risk exposure there is extremely important. And then, you know, the authentication issue is something that needs to be addressed, I think, by most organizations that are, you know, the ones that are already doing it, great. But there's always room for improvement. Building strong authentication and authorization directly into apps and APIs is incredibly important and will save you, you know, many headaches in the future.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, they just kind of randomly, I was looking at OWASP's top 10 the other day, and broken access controls are still, you know, number one right up there. And so this is a very common thing that organizations are dealing with. So it all accords, you know? Joe, how about you? What are the kind of positive takeaways and recommendations you feel like defenders should take here?
Well, I think it never grows old, but human education should be at the top of your priority list in any of the areas that you work with. But it's just taking a look at the actual report and everything, and I'm going to steal what Chris said, the outcome shouldn't be that difficult. It's just focus on your authentication. multi-factor authentication is very important. There are things that are already out there, outline how to do them, best practices, so on and so forth. If you follow that, you should be okay.
And so there's kind of almost like a silver lining there, right? Which is that, like, on the one hand, some of this security 101 stuff, we're still struggling with it. But on the other hand, it means the fix is not that complicated, right? Like there is, you know, we kind of know what to do already. And so it's not like it's hopeless, you know? Claire, take us home. You know, what's your take here in terms of the positive takeaways for organizations from this report?
Yeah, I think the report's a really good reminder that AI can be exploited, but also that you can use AI to your advantage to further secure your organization. You can use it to automate and reduce human fatigue. You can use it to just overall help your organization. It shouldn't be a bad thing. We should use it to our advantage to help with our security.
Yeah, and honestly, it's a very nice place to end this segment, because the next two, we're going to be harping on AI a little bit, but it is good to remember that it is actually a useful tool in the right hands, right? And going back to what Chris said at the top, talk about inventorying everything. That's the kind of place where I feel like AI can really help, because as a human being, how are you going to manually inventory everything that's exposed, right? All right, let's move on to our next story for today. Malware that steals AI agents' souls and AI agents as malware. Two stories this week about AI agent security from opposite ends of the spectrum, but together I think they shed some light on the full breadth of the AI agent threat landscape. On the one hand, you've got research from Hudson Rock reporting on the case of an info stealer being used to steal a victim's OpenClaw configuration environment, including the sol.md file that includes details of an agent's operating principles, behavioral guidelines, and ethical boundaries. Basically, not to anthropomorphize agents, but its personality, if you will. The other story entails someone hiding OpenClaw inside of compromised NPM packages for the AI coding tool Clyne. So instead of delivering malware to a victim's device, it was secretly installing an AI agent on them. The compromised package was only live for 8 hours, and no one's really quite sure who was behind it or what the reason was. But still, it's a very interesting tactic. So, you know, I see here kind of two stories that show AI agents as both an attack vector and an attack target. And I'm wondering kind of what this says for the AI agent threat landscape. Claire, I want to start with you. And I specifically want to ask you about something that Hudson Rock says in the info stealer, said about the info stealer infection. This is a quote. It says, "This finding marks a significant milestone in the evolution of info stealer behavior. The transition from stealing browser credentials to harvesting the, quote, souls and identities of personal AI agents." What do you think about this idea of, like, stealing AI agent identities? Is this something we need to be worried about? What do you think could happen here?
Yeah, I'm hesitant about calling the information a soul of an AI, just because people do anthropomorphize AI so much, and it's not real. It doesn't have feelings, all this. So, I mean, it's a real entity, but it doesn't have feelings. It doesn't have emotion, et cetera. But I think it is something that we do explore with clients. You know, the thought that their LLM may be stolen, that may contain sensitive information. Sometimes, depending on the organization, it may contain financials or it may contain specific policies. I think it's something that people are very concerned about. I think there's a lot with AI that people are concerned about, either in using shadow AI or like their LLM in general being stolen. Because that could be super harmful depending what lives in it and what's attached to it.
Absolutely. And I can also kind of imagine a sort of situation where in stealing your AI agent's quote-unquote soul. And I share your reservations about saying the word soul. You know, I do think we need to be careful about anthropomorphizing these things. But it's such a catchy little phrase to use. But I do think I could see a situation where, like, an organization sets up, you know, their own kind of custom AI agents, right? You've got your own kind of proprietary personas for these things. And someone swoops in and steals those. And now they can just replicate what you're doing. And I can see that being really, really dangerous. Chris, I want to ask you about your take. You know, what do you think an attacker could do with an AI configuration? You know, how do you think this could play out? What's your take there?
Yeah, so, I mean, just reading that report, it's interesting. And one of the things that I thought of first was, you know, if an attacker were to gain, you know, or in this case, they kind of exfiltrated the quote unquote soul of the AI, right? You know, imagine now the same attacker were to ask, you know, this AI agent, you know, what are all the things I've ever asked you? Can you summarize all that for me? And now you're essentially pulling additional data from, you know, the AI model that you've taken, right? So now, depending on what the original user of that agent was doing, that could contain lots of really either sensitive information, personal information. You know, if it was work related, it could be, you know, sensitive business information, right? So there's a lot of potential security implications there. You know, if they were using that agent for coding or something like that, you know, there could be lots of things like that agent spits back out to you, you know, upon request, right? And just to tie this back to the report that's coming out this week, the Threat Intelligence Index, we actually observed quite a few info stealers that were that we've seen in previous years, now adding on like a module to do things like look for AI agent credentials as well. So the AI agent credential is just another one of these things that the info stealer malwares now are starting to look for and scrape, you know, in addition to your browser stored credentials and other apps that you might have on your workstation that stores credentials or whatever, browsing history. Just another facet of the info stealers is indeed AI related login information and session information and stuff like that. So that's already happening. We reported on that as well.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You know, I hadn't considered the kind of full extent to which, you know, a stolen agent can become like an endless source of personal data almost, right? Like, especially the way that people are using agents and being encouraged to use agents as these assistants who are, they're in your email, they're in your bank account, maybe even they're connected to all kinds of sensitive stuff. You might be having maybe some private conversations with them because, you know, people tend to do that sometimes. That can all come out if they've got access to your configuration files, your persona there. So that's just an added concern. Joe, how about you taking a look at this situation, AI agents becoming targets and specifically becoming targets, you know, for their configuration files, their personas? What's your take here? Any concerns you have about this?
So my concern is basically we're not using AI agents for almost everything, organizations in our personal lives as well. And they're being used without the thought on what's behind this, right? Are there any security guardrails that I have in place? It's just open to the world, or anything that I ask, or even the configuration. And let's take a step back. How about the training data that was used to create that agent? So all of that data in there that was used, and it's maybe there's no security around this, or there may be SPI inside of that training data that can be easily stolen if not taken into consideration on, okay, I'm now using this AI agent to perform now this productive work. It will save a lot of time, so on and so forth. But am I really asking the question, is it secure enough? Is it giving me the proper guardrails? Is it giving me the right login information for me to check if there's no malintent in something? So that governance part of AI, it's somewhat being forgotten as well. And that's my concern.
I don't know, absolutely. And that ties into, you know, this conversation, this ongoing conversation people are having about OpenClaw specifically, right? Because this is an AI agent that's kind of blown up. Oh, it's an open source agent. People have been using it. But the governance question is sort of second if it's asked at all, right? And a lot of people who may not even know what they're getting into can install this thing because there's like a pressure there, right? Of like, hey, get an agent, join this, jump on the bandwagon. It's so cool. Look what it can all do. And so not only are the questions not being asked, but I always worry that like the people installing it don't even know to ask the question in the first place. You know what I mean? And so it's like, how do you even start? I feel like there's a piece of education that could be there. But the other story here that I mentioned up top is this story of an infected NPM package dropping an AI agent. Again, it's OpenClaw, but it could be any agent, you know, as a kind of malware payload, right? Installing a secret agent on a user's device. Chris, I'll throw it to you then. What thoughts might you have on the use of AI agents as a kind of attack payload? What do you think's going on there?
I haven't thought of that particular kind of arrangement, but what I will say is that reminds me of just another, supply chain / third party type compromise here, because we've seen NPM packages that have been kind of poisoned before, right? Where we have, some malicious package kind of uploaded, and then, users unknowingly start to, download that package, install it, and it might operate as they're expecting, but it also, installs something to the side, right, that they might not have foreseen. So, but in these cases, they weren't AI agents, right? They were your typical type of malware or scripts or something like this. But, the use of that technique to deliver kind of these new AI agents, it really does open the door to a lot of nefarious activity, right? Because those things are given quite a large amount of permissions. I think the danger obviously lies in the fact that when this thing runs, it's being run without, the user's knowledge, right? So I think it's certainly an avenue that, as this becomes more prevalent, I think we might start seeing more of that, just because it does seem like, based on kind of the reporting and what is potentially possible there, it seems like it could be quite disruptive, and for an attacker, it could be an avenue they want to explore.
Yeah, that's kind of my concern too, right, is that this becomes, a much more common kind of payload, right? And so now we're not just talking about an info steal or a ransomware. We're talking about a payload that can act semi-autonomously at least, right? Like that raises some concerns for me. Joe, how about you, your take on AI agents as a malware payload? Like, do you think this is the beginning of something we might see more of, or, just a kind of one-off experiment? How do you feel like this affects things?
Well, I feel that it definitely does. It's opening the door to something new. And the concern there would be is, am I using something that I trust? It wasn't inherently built as something malicious, right? It wasn't really the original intent, but it's something I currently trust, and then it was repurposed to be malicious and for an outcome, for the malicious outcome. But I already trust it, and Chris was saying, you already have given it a lot of permissions. It runs in the background without your knowledge, but you already trust in it, and then it was repurposed, right? Could that be it? Could that be that door that it's been opened, which is highly concerning, right? Because it's something that's already in that trusted list within your organization.
Yeah, and I think, honestly, that's a really nice segue into our third story, actually, which almost is not even a separate story because we're still on this AI tip here, but specifically talking about the weakness of AI infrastructure. As you point out, Joe, this is a situation where something that is kind of trusted might be used to do some pretty nasty things, right? And I think this Cisco report, Cisco's State of AI Security 2026 report, points at what that might look like, right? This report released last week warns that core components of today's AI infrastructure are vulnerable to exploitation. Here's a quote. The rapid adoption of the Model Context Protocol and agent-to-agent protocols has created a vast and often unmonitored attack surface, right? Cisco cites real-world attacks such as a fake Postmark MCP server package that secretly copied every email sent by an AI agent to kind of point out that the connective tissue here for these agents is kind of weak, right? Other aspects of the supply chain come in for scrutiny too. Quote, most of the model repositories and internal pipelines provide no cryptographic assurances of who trained a model, what data influenced it, whether it has been modified since publication, or even its country of origin. So, Joe, this comes back to the governance question that you brought up, right? This idea that, that governance is kind of lacking. And I'd like to ask you, especially in the context of, the model repositories that we're working with, do you have any thoughts on what kind of governance you'd like to see there? What should be there? Any takes?
I think it's twofold, because first you have your, organization's request of let's go ahead and automate repetitive tasks. And it needs to come with an A2C list on I need to do this, this, and this, and this, and this are all musts, right? But as well, There's one thing that's very important not to leave behind, which is also the user's ability to create their own without that organization's permission. And you can have a very strong governance program in what's vetted by you and authorized by you, but what about the ease of just going out online and creating an app of my own just to still automate what I'm doing? Is there any control in governments around that? Where is my company's data being posted on, and my name and my reputation and everything? It's going there. And this is all open to the world, and anyone can use it. So yes, if it's in your organization, you must have a governance program and model that dictates how to use the tools and also the steps that you need to take to make sure that it has been tested and vetted and authorized and approved, not only for the code itself, but also what data is going to be exposed, especially with the SPI, SPIs, but as well what happens with my employees and people around my organization using it on their own. Right, and kind of freelancing their own automation as well. You need to have that governance as well in your own data going out there.
Absolutely. Yeah, that shadow AI question, right, of like what happens when people bring in their own models, start giving them access to very sensitive organizational information. Again, you know, with AI, there's like a threat over and above what you have with normal shadow IT, right? And so you can see it misusing that organizational data in a really serious way. Chris, how about you? Do you kind of feel like our AI infrastructure is weaker than it should be? Like, should it be better off right now? Or what's your take? How do you feel about it?
The one comment I have is that it's kind of disheartening to see that, you know, despite all the, you know, security awareness that the industry has kind of been putting out for years about, you know, putting security first, for the development and implementation of all these different types, not just AI, but any kind of application that you're rolling out. And now we're seeing, you know, this whole new family of technology, and it still seems like the security thing is looked at as kind of a, let's just fix it after, or let's consider it after the fact, as opposed to doing it up front, which is, you know, it seems like we've been preaching that for many years. And, you know, people claim to hear it, but then, you know, as soon as a new technology comes out and, you know, everyone's racing to get things to market, it's like the security is the first thing to take a back seat once again. And, you know, it's, you know, I'm not saying it's not repairable, but I think that it's just, we need to keep harping on that and, you know, make sure that those issues don't become, you know, things that need band-aids later on. It's... Unfortunately, I think it's we've seen this story before.
Yeah, and you know, I feel like the organic kind of theme that's been developing throughout this episode, and I love when this happens, but it keeps going back to that phrase that Claire said all the way up top that has really stuck with me. You know, the speed of security and the speed of business are not always necessarily the same speed, right? And it's like you said, Chris, I do feel like we've seen this cycle play out so many times where it's like, just as you feel like we're getting these things synced up, a new technology comes out, and then the mismatch happens again. And you're really seeing this mismatch a lot with AI, because there is the pressure on the one hand to adapt, to adopt, to get in on the ground floor. But, you know, the security challenges that AI poses are so different from what we've seen before, right? I feel like there's no analog to like a prompt injection, for example, with just a web app or something like that. You know, I want to ask you, Claire, about this next bit, because, Cisco's report is almost pessimistic about what it would take to change this, right? And they kind of say that, like, look, it might take something like a SolarWinds-level attack to get people to change their behavior. For any listeners who might not be familiar, SolarWinds was a compromise where, you know, hackers, they compromised a software update system so that they could just push out, you know, compromised updates to people's platforms. And so everybody trusted the updates because they were coming from the software and they were loaded with malicious payloads. Claire, as somebody who does work in education with organizations, do you feel like it takes that level of an attack to get people to change their behavior? Like, what do you think it takes? Any thoughts there?
I don't know if it would take that for just all industries. I don't know if it would take that. I think we've seen it happen in a couple of specific industries, and that really gets people to act. I think it It would take a big example, I think, to make people think about it a little bit more. Something Chris said made me think of the phrase security should be built in, not bolted on. And that is something that's very difficult to get people to think about because there is a time and a cost associated with that. I think SolarWinds was a big deal, but I think learnings there can also be applied here because it is a big supply chain issue. Even though it's not necessarily AI related, I think it does have to do, you know, a lot with thinking of, are you testing and deploying applications? Are you connecting to the right vendors? It goes back to that concept of due diligence. Are you actually looking into everything that you should be? If you're deploying new AI applications, are you testing them? Are you testing them regularly following deployment? I think it might take a SolarWinds-like scenario to make it to make people care a little bit more, but SolarWinds, that scenario should apply here too, because it was a huge supply chain issue.
No, that's a really good point, and I'm glad you kind of bring up that. And because I'm guilty of this too, but sometimes the AI can feel so kind of new and different that you almost feels like it's unprecedented, right? But like you said, you know, SolarWinds was a massive supply chain breach, but AI is also in the supply chain. And so you can learn from non-AI supply chain breaches your best practices to apply here. Like we're not starting from scratch. It's not a blank slate, no matter how different it seems. And I think that's a really important lesson to keep in mind. On that note, folks, let's move on to our final story for today, a more human approach to threat intelligence. In an op-ed for Dark Reading, Dr. Megan Squire advocates for a new approach to threat intelligence, quote, organized around human vulnerabilities rather than adversary types. The point that Dr. Squire is making is basically that we tend to think of things like internet scams, malware research, and targeted harassment campaigns as these distinct spheres of activity. And so research into these fields doesn't necessarily always share information. But certain techniques, many techniques, in fact, cross those boundaries. For example, Dr. Squire mentions that email bombing is often used to hide malware, harass people, and scam people, right? Like it's a tactic that spreads across all of this. If we, instead of organizing defenses around adversary types, we organized it around the kind of human vulnerabilities that they're targeting, we might make a little more progress on things. And I figured since we're talking about the Threat Intelligence Index, which is, you know, a really amazing report that shares incredible lessons that X-Force has learned and helps kind of knock down some threat intelligence silos by putting that information out there, if this feels like a natural story to end on. So, Chris, I want to ask you, you know, somebody who works in threat intel, you know, what's your take on this idea? Do you feel that the field can be kind of siloed sometimes? Would you like to see it knocked down a little bit more? What's your take?
I understand an argument from both sides. I think it's important to have expertise in certain specialties, especially when you're, you know, tracking certain threat actors who operate in a very specific way. But then when you go ahead and speak to, you know, or try to educate, whether it's clients of ours or customers, you know, they might want to know, have information about, well, tell me about, you know, nation state threat actors that might target us. And, you know, as an intel analyst, you know, as we're observing their security practices, you know, it's not that they shouldn't be worried about that, but what they should be worried about is something that could mitigate problems from both avenues, right? So in that case, like, sure, bucketing them together and taking a more human approach could be valuable, because at the end of the day, I mean, it would be bad to have a cyber incident from either an advanced cyber criminal threat actor or a nation state. It's both a problem for you, you know, but the solution could be one and the same. If you're willing to kind of make those security adjustments. So a lot of times we hear, you know, they want to know about threat X, Y, and Z that's only in this category. But as an analyst, you know, it might benefit us to tell them, like, you know, the threats are the threats and they're going to be the same, you know, regardless. The entry point is still the same regardless of who we're talking about, right? Who's behind the keyboard on the other end. So I think, you know, the point made in that article is one that I think we can all consider as something to, you know, to take into consideration when we're conducting research or talking to clients, customers. But, you know, threat intel is a field where it's always changing. You know, it's kind of dictated by the activity of adversaries in this case, right? So I think it's a good take.
And I like that you point out that, you know, there's a reason that some of this specialized expertise develops, right? Like, it's not like a, you know, a completely arbitrary thing to close these things off. There are differences, right? And so it makes sense that there would be specialized expertise, but, you know, build some more bridges between those kinds of things. It might be helpful, right? Joe, you know, you're well experienced in collaborative approaches to cybersecurity. You know, I know you helped start the Costa Rica cybersecurity cluster, right? I'm wondering if you could talk maybe a little bit about how you feel about kind of collaborative approaches to threat intelligence and cybersecurity. And I don't know, maybe even some lessons you learned from your work with the cluster that we could help apply here. Any takes?
Well, yeah, one of the key items that we always show in the cluster, or that we try to bring together, it's like, okay, let's put everyone into a single room. Let's put all the CISOs and different levels into the same room to share experiences, because you see the mentality of everyone. It's like, it won't happen to me. It won't be my problem, or even I've never thought of that. So when you share the stories and get out of your day to day and say like, well, even though we're in different organizations, maybe different markets, the different approach to cybersecurity, there are things that are best practices that someone else already lived through it and someone else already did it. So that collaborative approach, it's very important, because that's when you realize the things that you haven't done, the things that you haven't thought of, and the things that you need to put in your priority list somewhere.
No, that makes perfect sense. This idea that, like, you know, you don't know what you don't know, right? And so when you get in the room with other people, they can point out things, gaps that you never even knew you needed to kind of close, right? Like, you would have no reason to know that they were there if you didn't have that. I really like that idea. Claire, I want to ask you, were recently, last week, on our romance scams episode, which is a topic that really straddles these kinds of lines that Dr. Squire was talking about, right? It's a cyber attack, it's an emotional scam, it's social engineering, it's all of these things. What are your thoughts on the kind of boundaries we sometimes draw between attack types? I mean, do you think we get a little too, you know, classification happy? Could we be a little more fluid? I don't know. You have any thoughts there?
Matt, you must have been reading my mind, because this was in my notes for this article. So I'm not a threat intelligence expert or analyst, but I work with a lot of people who consume threat intelligence, you know, from the client side. I consume a lot of threat intelligence. And I think this article brings up an interesting concept, at least for me, that a lot of our security is in general built for the security person. And I think threat intelligence can be kind of built for the human in general. I think at least in education, we think a lot about what this information can do for the organization, but we don't always think about what it can do for the human in terms of protecting them from financial loss or impacting data loss, you know, identity theft, that kind of thing. And I mean, what goes on in terms of, I'm a customer service agent, so no one's going to come to, nation state isn't going to come to me. I think that's really important in our education, that we kind of say, like, yes, you are suspect to, or not suspect, you are susceptible to different scams and different fraud that impacts you, your family, potentially, your organization. I think it does help for more, you know, for different audiences to kind of break it down by different type of threat actor. But I think at the end of the day, it is really key to remind people of the different tactics that these groups take. And maybe you don't care that it's a nation state impacting you, or a major trafficking group victim group that's impacting you for a romance scam. I think it's just very important to keep education as human-centered as possible. And yeah, you can remind people that this is something a nation-state group will do, but it's also something that could impact you personally. You kind of have to give people a vested interest in how it could impact them personally sometimes as well.
Yeah, I really like that, because I feel like it almost brings this full circle, right? Because you talk about a threat intelligence that maybe is more digestible for, you know, the average person, or maybe that's not even the right way to put it, but like, threat intelligence can serve multiple audiences, right? Like, it doesn't, there, we can think about threat intelligence for those threat intelligence analysts who are like in the room doing that work, but also a kind of threat intelligence that might be useful for your everyday people, right? And to kind of close this out here, Chris, as somebody who worked on this threat intelligence index report, which is, you know, that's a piece of threat intelligence meant to be spread, meant to be disseminated publicly. Do you have any thoughts about, you know, a kind of threat intelligence that is more widely, you know, digestible for a regular audience? Is that something you feel like you'd like to see too, or you've seen before? I don't know. Any takes there?
Yeah, I mean, in the threat intelligence world, I mean, we have three different types of intelligence kind of that we focus on producing, right? We have like the operational kind, the tactical kind, and the strategic kind. And the strategic kind is kind of geared toward those who might, you know, make strategy decisions and stuff like this, and they're far less technical. And they're designed to kind of explain how certain threats can impact you beyond the obvious, right? Like, you know, you don't need the nuts and bolts to understand that this could cause a problem for you. And I think that same type of language and explanation can trickle down to really anybody who's consuming that information. I mean, I think that the bigger challenge is getting folks to actually intend to look to actually consume the information, right? Most people don't go, you know, opening the internet and looking for the latest threat intelligence reports, even if they're easy to read and to understand. And it's just, you know, it's just the way it is. So I think, you know, we have to do our part to make sure that we make it available and then, you know, spread the word of its importance. But I do think that there is a world where that can happen.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point to kind of close out on. I mean, look, it's easy to forget sometimes that, you know, not everybody is on the internet looking at threat intelligence all day like we kind of are, or reading about cybersecurity or thinking about it all the time. But when you put this stuff out there, you at least make it available. And I think a report like Threat Intelligence Index, you know, it digs into the nitty gritty, but also, you know, right up top, you have a nice little executive summary that really kind of lays it out in language that I think anybody can kind of understand. So I feel like it's one of those things that does both. That does it for this episode, folks. I want to thank you, our panelists, Claire and Chris and Joe. Thank you to the viewers and the listeners. As always, subscribe to Security Intelligence wherever podcasts are found. Stay safe out there, and please do go check out the full 2026 Threat Intelligence Index. There, I really mean it when I say there is so much more in there that we didn't get into that is well worth your time.